if only we were good, we'd be socialist, which is a belief that I think almost everybody has, regardless of whether they call themselves socialist or not.
Hi, I'm Rob Monk with Reason TV, and I'm here today with Georgetown professor of philosophy Jason Brennan, and we're here to talk about his new book, Why Not Capitalism? Every college freshman in this country, within 1 week of taking their first political theory class, has said, as if they're the first person to ever think it, of course socialism is the best in theory. Of course, if we were able to scrub out some of the bugs of humans' programming, that's precisely the kind of society that we'd want to set up for each other. And your book is a direct attack upon that very particular idea.
The debate that I'm having here with this Marxist philosopher, Jerry Cohen, he basically wants to avoid talking about, well, what do we do in light of human failure? What do we do in light of the fact that people are badly motivated, that they're selfish, that they're mean, that they'll often use power for their own ends? He says, there's a question about what's the best response to that, but that's whatever the answer is, we're not talking about justice here. We're talking about what we do in the real world full of unjust people. He retreats to the moral high ground. He retreats back to that idea that if only we were good, we'd be socialist, which is a belief that I think almost everybody has, regardless of whether they call themselves socialist or not. They'll imagine a kind of socialist utopia in which we're all kind of working together collectively on projects, and we're all very happy to do that, and we share with one another, and we're generous. And that's wonderful, and there's no reason to be against that. And in a capitalist system, we would have that kind of thing too. People live in collectives. I'm a capitalist, but I live in a commune. My house is a commune, effectively. The thing that I think socialists are often missing is that we're not the Borg from Star Trek. We have private lives. We want privacy as well. We want to engage in private pursuits, like projects of our own undertaking that we do by ourselves, not with others. And so what I'd like to say to my socialist colleagues is, if you can understand why you wouldn't want to, say, write a philosophy paper with the collective, you'd rather write a philosophy paper by yourself, or if you can understand why you'd like to paint a painting by yourself rather than having it done collectively as a group project, you can understand why someone might find a kind of meaning in running a business by himself, or having a factory, or having a farm that's his rather than a collective farm. So ideally what you'd want is a system in which it's possible to realize multiple different kinds of utopian existences all at the same time. So for you, given your personal dispositions, given your preferences, it might be that your idea of like the perfect society would be one which is kind of a small fishing village where everyone knows each other personally. For me, it might be something more like a large city in which with a lot of advanced technology. For some other person, it might be kind of an Israeli kibbutz. And for someone else, it might be a small sort of bourgeois town where people are buying and trading and selling and doing mercantile activity. And there's no reason to think that any one of these visions of how the world could go is going to be best for every single person. So ideally what you want is a system under which you can realize all these different conceptions of the good life and different conceptions of a good community.
A secondary critique as well that you make about the notion of socialist utopia, and it's this idea that goes by the technical term, the information problem. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is?
In order for us to have cooperation on a massive scale, cooperation on a scale of millions or tens of millions, we need some sort of signal that tells us what's going on in the economy. It turns out in economics, we get that signal in market societies, and it's in the form of prices. Think of like a Coca-Cola, say, using aluminum cans. It might be that somewhere on the other side of the world there's a disaster in the mine, and then it's a little bit harder to mine aluminum, and the price of aluminum will go up a little bit because people compete to buy it. And then it comes to Coca-Cola and they say, well, aluminum is a little bit more expensive. We don't even know why, but we'll just switch over to using plastic bottles and use less aluminum, and then the price will change as a result of that. And we're all making all these private decisions, and it modifies prices a little bit, and then we respond appropriately. We don't know what's causing scarcity. We don't know what other people's desires are or demands are. We can just see that the price of strawberries is cheap over here and it's expensive over here, and that tells me everything I need to know as the consumer about what to do with the strawberries in order to best satisfy other people's needs. The problem with massive socialism on a mass scale, is that they don't have a substitute for prices. So socialist planners have to basically guess. And that's why socialism on a large scale never ends up working, because the socialist planners literally don't have the information that they need to make rational economic decisions.
And I think that's really important, because in Washington, D.C., I do not think that there is a cabal of closeted socialists that want to bring about a Marxist revolution. But there is a very prevalent, particularly among the elite political pundit class, like a kind of light, maybe less dangerous version of the socialist conceit, which is, a lot of these pundits have ample number of Ivy League degrees, and they hang around with a lot of other smart people, and they begin to operate under the assumption that it's just a matter of putting a couple key super intelligent people in charge, and they'd be able to see everything, hack it all, and figure out how to readjust, like, you know, the economic infrastructure of America.
In principle, there are cases where an omnibenevolent, omniscient dictator could come in and fix the market and make it better. In principle, that's the case. It's rarely going to be the case in actuality that a person knows when and how to intervene to improve it. So given the limits of human knowledge, given the limits of people's ability, and also just given their biases and so on, and the fact that they're likely to use this power selfishly rather than for our own good, I think it's better not to empower them to do these things.
You debunk this idea that sort of capitalist social technology engenders or cultivates certain vices,
yeah,
that it actually actively rewards greed and predatory behavior.
A wide range of people like Herbert Gintis and Paul Zak and Joseph Henrich and a number of other economists and anthropologists and others who study what markets do to people. One thing that they'll do is they'll have, say, take games. Like, there's this game called the Ultimatum game where it gives me the opportunity to cheat you. And they'll have people play this game from all over the world and then see what factors determine whether people play honestly or dishonestly. What they find is the biggest cultural predictor that you will be trusting, trustworthy, generous, fair, and so on is the extent to which you come from a market-oriented society. People from traditional societies, from tribal societies, from kind of non-pre-market societies, and from socialist societies are not nice.
The idea that I think that people of our political persuasion don't as actively engage with as I would like, mm-hmm, is this idea that there is an arbitrary distribution of attributes and advantages at, yeah, birth and by genetics and by environment. And someone with maybe more progressive politics, someone who's a bit more friendly to the notion of government intrusion, oftentimes that's based in an authentic and good-hearted desire to correct for those particular kind of arbitrary distributions of advantages.
You know, I'm not really concerned about equality in opportunity for its own sake. Society is not a race. No one has to win. It's a cooperative venture for mutual gain. So in a race, it's very important that everybody start in the same position because the purpose of a race is to measure relative performance and relative talent. That's not what society is about. It's just us cooperating with one another. So I think here the question isn't should we have equal opportunity, but rather should we have a political system or an economic system that tends to make sure that people have more opportunity rather than less, and then everybody have sufficient opportunity. What I end up doing in the book is saying that the capitalist utopia that I described, that's supposed to be juxtaposed and compared to and shown to be superior to the socialist utopia that Jerry Cohen describes, it endorses principles of social justice and endorses principles of beneficence, but the way that they achieve these goals is not through a kind of heavy-handed government intervention, but through private means.